Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, in honor of Halloween, we discuss the use of religion and spirituality in horror writing. We are joined by leading horror writers Tanana Reeve Du, Juan Martinez, and Matt Ruff. This conversation originally took place October 10th, 2025, and was recorded live at the University of Chicago Divinity School. This episode is presented in conjunction with the American Writers Museum's forthcoming exhibit, American Prophets, Writers, Religion, and Culture. This exhibit and programming series explores the profound ways writing reflects and influences our understanding of religion. American Prophets opens November 21st, 2025. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Hi, everybody. How are we doing tonight? I'm Kerry Cranston. I'm the president of the American Writers Museum. And right now, I'm going to introduce our very special guests. So tonight, we have three wonderful authors who are going to be in conversation. Tanana Reeve Du is an award-winning author who teaches Black horror and Afrofuturism at UCLA, a leading voice in Black speculative fiction for more than 20 years. Du has won an American Book Award, an NAACP Image Award, and a British Fantasy Award. Her writing has been included in many Best of the Year anthologies. Her books include The Reformatory, The Wishing Pool, and other stories, Ghost Summer Stories, My Soul to Keep, and The Good House. She and her late mother, civil rights activist Patricia Stevenson Du, co-authored Freedom in the Family, a mother-daughter memoir of the fight for civil rights. We also have Matt Ruff, who's an award-winning author of 8 novels, including Fool on the Hill, Set This House in Order, Bad Monkeys, The Mirage, 88 Names, and the best-selling Lovecraft Country, which was adapted as an HBO series, and I'm sure many of us saw that. His most recent book is The Destroyer of Worlds, A Return to Lovecraft Country. And Juan Martinez is a writer and associate professor of English at Northwestern University. And for those of you from U of C, yes, we brought a Northwestern professor down here. He is the author of the horror novel Extended Stay and of the story collection Best Worst American, which is one of my favorite collections of short stories ever. He is also the fiction editor of Jackleg Press, and Juan lives with his family near Chicago. So, welcome.
So excited to see so many people on a Friday in a beautiful day in Chicago when it's completely possible to be still outside. It just makes me really, really good. So grateful for the invitation, but also to Tanana Reeve and to Matt for this conversation. I had floated this to Matt before, but I just wanted to look at it. Just start with this question, which is only adjacent to religion and a little bit maybe more close to just real-life horrors here, which is, I know that we're in a really difficult moment, not just in Chicago, but nationally. And there's this impulse in me to go, oh, there's been nothing like this before. And it struck me both, I'm Colombian, so like wait a minute, no, I've seen stuff like this before. But then I had a chance to revisit Matt's work, Tanana Reeve's work, and then it just struck me, wait a minute, they're really pointing to lots and lots of moments in American history where very similar dynamics have bubbled up. And so my question had a little bit to do that. What's it like to feel like the history that you've been grappling with in your fiction is sort of like returning in another, yet another sort of like ugly and, you know, still kind of familiar form. But if you don't mind, we can start with that big, huge question, and then we can move on to horror and religion and other things too.
What does it feel like? That's the question?
Yeah, what does it feel like right now? Yeah, it doesn't feel good.
It feels sickening, actually. You know, my late mother, Patricia Stevens Du, used to always sign our memoir, well, I was the dream lives and she was the struggle continues. So she was always sort of bracing for this in a way that I found odd because I grew up as a beneficiary of the advances in the civil rights era. I never saw a white only sign, you know? So I was like, what do you, you changed it. It's fixed. I mean, it was never fixed. But of course, this march backward is horrifying. And I decided to use that with my latest novel, The Reformatories. Like I could see that happening before my eyes. So sure, let's take a novel and set it in 1950, but it really represents our current prison industrial complex, our current juvenile justice system, and hopefully people will better understand the times we're in now based on reading a novel written in history.
Yeah, no, I mean, that struck me too when I was sort of revisiting the reformatory for this. It's like, oh, I forgot how incredibly arbitrary that initial arrest is and how it very quickly devolves once he's in the prison itself. And Matt, it's the same question.
I mean, in my case, I try not to comment on the current moment, in part because I'm aware of my own ability as a writer to sort of hypnotize myself into believing that things are different than they really are. I actually like having some time to think about what's really going on, what do I really think about it, not just react in the moment. And I feel particularly in this moment right now, a lot of people have just hypnotized themselves into thinking this is a unique apocalyptic moment, and it's not. It's worse things have happened, similar things have happened. And the things that may make this moment different, like the existence of social media that puts us all on a 24-hour, you can go out there and find somebody who's thinking something that just drives you crazy anytime you want, that feels new, but we won't really know what it means until another 10 or 20 years down the road. And for me, part of it is I'm just hoping I live long enough to see how the story turns out. But I have faith that the country will come through this. It's just going to be a question of how much damage is done in the meantime. So one of the nice things about working with more historical scenarios going back 50, 70 years is that a lot of smart people have had time to think about and talk about it. And then I can sort of pick through that and say what makes sense to me and how I want to deal with it in the fiction I'm writing.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense to me. And you're pointing to like something that I kind of find both comforting about both of y'all's work is that there is an acknowledgement, right, of the weight of oppression, the weight of history, the way in which
Sure.
these inequities sort of like show up. But there's also a fundamental belief in the possibility for some change here and there, and that I really, really appreciate. I did have questions for you about religion
Okay.
and about horror, this one is going to get. I just thought that we could get like really nerdy first,
Sure.
if that's okay. And I was kind of thinking about the ways in which Tananarive, in your case, I'm thinking in particular of The Good House and Voodoo. And Matt, can I think about a lot of things, but also like I love the cults in Lovecraft Country and Destroyer of Worlds.
Yeah, you and I were discussing John Crowley before
Love
upstairs.
Crowley.
And actually, I was sort of, I mean, my idea of the sort of the white cultists in Lovecraft Country was that they were the kind of people who thought they were too smart to believe in God, but kind of do anyway. And there's this whole subtext of, yeah, it's sort of, they're not doing magic, they're doing science that, it's sort of natural science. And I got that a lot from the way some Renaissance people who practice what today we would recognize as alchemy or. But back then, because science hadn't been codified, they were kind of the same thing, that you did math, but you also did astrology. You did, Isaac Newton did alchemy. And so this sort of reverses that, where you've got people doing magic, but referring to it as just, no, we're doing science, we're understanding the way the world really works. And, these stories about God and stuff, that's the simpleton's version. These are metaphors for the way things work. But the point is that, at least in Lovecraft Country, no, that stuff is real. And because you think you're too smart to fall for it, actually makes you vulnerable in a way that a believer would know not to be, I think.
And Tananarive, it's roughly the same question for you, specifically in The Good House, in how sort of belief kind of both drives the narrative, but also like this sort of recovery of lost knowledge kind of like plays a really, really huge part. But I think that's a more granular question. I think pulling back, I was also kind of wondering how you see faith itself as sort of being like a really good engine for novels, for like stories.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
Yeah.
I like that. Because The Good House, for people who haven't read it, is about a contemporary woman who moves into her grandmother's ancestral home, where her grandmother was known in the Pacific Northwest as sort of a voodoo queen who could brew these healing teas. And she considers it a very offensive stereotype until she discovers that her grandmother was very much a practitioner of voodoo as a faith. And I introduced this element of a trick she played on one of the Loas, which is why her family had this intergenerational curse. So my character's journey is from unbelief and shame to belief to figuring out how to work within the framework of these rules she's just learned to try to overpower a demon from this tradition. And opposite her is an old love interest who's a very strong Christian and has a lot of faith in Christianity, does not believe at all in her stories of what's happened in her grandmother's curse, but loves her. So is basically willing to walk with her despite not believing. It's interesting how these two characters, you know, one character who believes he's a man of faith has to sort of accept that what he believes is not everything. And a woman who did not believe she had any faith discovers that there are these powers that she and lineage that she's a part of. So yeah, faith is very much a character in the story. And I would say even in the reformatory, not in the religious sense even, but just the notion of faith, that you can believe yourself free, that you can believe yourself out of a situation. And I just came out of a family emergency where I was taxed every day with this notion of faith. So it's very powerful.
It is. Tanarif, I was also thinking about the deep sort of belief, faith that the brother and the sister in the reformatory have for each other, right? Like the sort of like, because they're cut off. I mean, in so much of the narrative of the story, they're cut off from each other, and yet there's this desperate and like incredibly moving sense that they, oh, no, she's out there, she's looking for me, or like, no, he knows that I'm sorry, that's, I don't know if that made sense, but like, that is, that I saw that as a little bit of like faith to this, this sort of like very deep familial bond, which also, Matt, in your books, like the family seems to also be such a huge part of that.
Well, I come from an interesting family, so... For those who don't know, yeah, my dad was a Lutheran minister, originally from the Midwest, and then after the failure of his first marriage, he came east and became a hospital chaplain in New York City. My mother was a missionary's daughter who was born in Brazil and grew up in Argentina during the Peron years and then eventually came north to New York City as well. And our house in Queens was Ellis Island for all of the other South American relatives coming north. And in addition to the sort of North American, South American cultural split, there was a fraction of the family that had become Mormon, most notably my maternal grandmother, who lived with us when she was older. And very often when one of the cousins would come to the house, they'd put their bags down, immediately grab a Bible, and go downstairs to try to bring grandma back to the true faith, as if that were a thing that could happen. So I grew up in this multicultural theological debate society, and it influenced my writing significantly in that I realized I was going to be spending my life on this planet surrounded by people who didn't think the way that I did, that I couldn't kill, and that I somehow had to figure out a way to get along with. And so my books are all over the map, really, in terms of genre and subject matter, but I like writing about culture clashes. I like writing about weird, complicated families, and I like writing from the point of view of protagonists who are different from me in some significant way, who come from a different background, who come from a different faith, perhaps, who have different challenges than I do, and discovered I have a knack for that, and Lovecraft Country is, of course, a good example of that. It's set in Chicago in the 1950s, and it's about a black family who run a travel agency and publish a fictional version of the Green Book. And people are sometimes puzzled when they see my picture on the author photo. But to me, it's just an example of what I've always wanted to do. It's my version of religion is trying to understand other folks, and one way to do that is by trying to write honestly from their point of view. So. Sorry, I kind of wandered from your point, but this is very much, it's like the whole world is kind of my family, so that's the thing. Those weird relationships between people that you really you're never going to see eye to eye. You're always going to be fighting with them in some senses. But at the end of the day, you still got to wake up the next day and be part of the same family. So,
no, I think that's connected. I do feel like that's definitely part of what I was trying to get at. And Tanari, I mean, you've written about this both in, you know, in nonfiction, but also like in your novels. But I'm kind of wondering if that is something that you've ever quite been able to articulate, right? Like this connection between family, faith, you know, your mother's participation in the civil rights movement, all of those things. How, you know, it feels like a very powerful network of things that helped make it happen. But like, how do you think it through? How do you see that connection between faith and family and story?
You know, it's so interesting. You know, my grandmother was AME. So sometimes I African Methodist Episcopal, sometimes I would go to church with her, which is more of a traditional Black church. And I love the choirs, of course. The music is very stirring. If God had a sound, it's gospel music to me. But my parents were Unitarian, so both had been raised AME, but had fallen away from that church. And, you know, we were raised, my sisters and I were raised where we had the cross, the Star of David, and the yin-yang all up there behind the altar. One of the ministers got fired because she talked about God too much. So I think from a very young age, sort of religious faith was just sort of a journey I had to sort of absorb on my own. And as a family, our religion was civil rights and politics. That was the and as the engine for change, and there was some overlap in terms of the Black church and its involvement in the civil rights era, which was very, very significant. But mostly it was the politics. It was the agitation. It was the marching. It was the organizing. So having grown up in a family where I felt that my parents literally had changed the world, that as young people, they fell into the civil rights movement, they took part in demonstrations that led to legislation, that led to laws, that led to very concrete change in just one generation, at least on the surface. My generation, Generation X, had a very, very different experience than my mother's generation did. And that instills something powerful in you, the notion that one person literally can go to a meeting and rally five other people, and the next thing you know, it's 500 people, is a very, very powerful thing to understand. And many of my characters in my books are questioning of traditional faith. You know, some of them are Christian, some of them have fallen away from Christianity, some of them are Jewish. But there's this notion of faith that I do think runs as a current through a lot of my work, and it definitely was instilled in me by my parents, although not by the most traditional means.
That actually, so I have like these two questions, and they're not related. They're connected to everything you all have said, and also to some of the stuff that I love in your work. And actually, Tananarive, I just realized it is connected, and that is, there's some like really kind of wonderfully sharp jabs at organized religion at voodoo, like I love sort of the turns that the Good House takes at the beginning on this, and Matt, Destroyer of Worlds, has this like lovely, lovely conversation on near the end, if I'm remembering right, where like the son is like, I don't think I believe, right? And and it's this beautiful sort of like, so, but in both cases, I see this sort of like. And I was kind of wondering, do you have a favorite in your own work where you're like sort of like really like laying it out there, like wrestling with like, all right, here's why belief fails for me, and if so, like, what is it like to write it? I know that sometimes when we're writing these things, it kind of changes how we feel about them almost as we're doing them. So, Tananarive, do you have a favorite from? I'm sorry, I'm pointing to The Good House, but like anywhere in your work that you're.
I don't know if this addresses it directly, but there's a moment in my novel, The Reformatory, where Gloria, the older sibling, is wrestling with faith. And I think where a lot of people struggle with traditional religion or even struggle with the notion of God is, how do such bad things happen to good people if there's a God? story after story is people of faith run headlong into something unjust, something terrible, something tragic, and they wrestle with that notion. And Gloria's answer to this, and one thing I love about child narrators is the clarity they have when they look at this, is that it must be that God sleeps sometimes. He blinks and there's a hurricane, and that works for me. It works for me. So that's, the most recent attempt I made to sort of confront this notion of belief, literally in God, or organized religions that are created to try to give us access to God.
I also just want to add, because I love Gloria so much, and one of the things that I found awesome and like really kind of like, I was like, how is she pulling this off? It's like Gloria is not, it's not like she's saintly, but she is such a good kid. Like she's such a, like there's like such a like care in the way that she presents herself to the world, such a like attention to everything. So she's like and she really is a believer, right? Like, so that all that, I think made her wrestling with faith all the more moving. It's just, I'm sorry, I just wanted to say that. That wasn't a question.
Well,
that was just
I
me
appreciate
going,
that. I mean, yeah. She envies the older woman, her godmother's just sort of unquestioning belief. She looks at that and is like, wow, that is great that you have that. She's not quite there, but she's finding her way.
Well, I also love that it's such a good, clear sibling dynamic too, right? That, that her brother's, he's also great, but he's not as, I was that brother. I was the one who like, didn't make my bed, didn't do the thing. She like is so good about all the things.
That was my mom. I based her on my mom. Oh. My mother's middle name was Gloria. So she, everything that's good about her, that is based on my mother's very ethical walk in the world.
Yeah, no, I was kind of like, it felt like a weird love letter to discipline in a novel that really, yeah. Anyway, and Matt, you, like I was pointing to that conversation, but like, you've tackled this in your work as a whole too, right?
I mean, yeah. I guess for me, the biggest challenge has always been reconciling the conservative Christianity I was raised in. The point was you had to believe a very specific thing to be saved, and the question that I inevitably ended up asking, but well, what about everybody else who believes other things? And the way I would talk about this, I went to a parochial school when I was in grade school, and it was in the 70s, it was post-civil rights movement, so it was a pretty progressive for its day. It was racially integrated, and we were taught, racism is wrong, anti-Semitism is wrong. But it was this weird dichotomy where, yes, and in school we'd be taught, yes, Adolf Hitler was evil because he took Jewish people and threw them into ovens, as you should be taught, that that's bad. But then on Wednesday we go to chapel, and of course the Lutheran theology is, well, God took the Jews out of those ovens along with all the other non-believers and threw them into a lake of eternal fire to suffer forever for denying Christ. And I was like, well, wait a minute. And then when I'm not in school or in chapel, I'm in New York City hanging out with my friends David Weber and Stephen Bernstein, who, they were Jewish for the same reason I was Christian, because that was what their parents were. And the idea of salvation being run on essentially a birth lottery just didn't make a lot of sense to me. And so I would say I probably stopped believing in hell before I stopped believing in God. But the problem is, if you take hell out of the equation, then you're left with the question, well, what did Jesus die for? And there are liberal theological answers to that question, but they all basically come down to turning the Bible story into a kind of metaphor or a beautiful story about, there are many ways to God or something like that. And I'm like, okay, well, if I'm going to wake up early on Sunday and put on an uncomfortable suit and sit in a hard pew, I need it to be real. I need this to be the way that you're going to get something done. If it's just a nice story, I kind of got that covered on my own. I think I'll sleep in and just tell some stories. Yeah. And so the specific scene you're talking about, where Horace is talking to his mother, it's somewhat different. He's leaning more into the, I'm a black kid growing up in America in the 1950s, and I'm starting to realize what a bad hand I've been dealt, and I would really like to believe God is going to help with this, and if he's not real, then how do I go on? So it's much more of a, you know, when bad things happen to good people, but it's personalized. It's Horace dealing with that, and then with that point in your life when you start to realize that death is a real thing that's going to happen to you. So there's some crossover there, and I was certainly thinking a lot about my own childhood when I was writing that, but the part about, you know, why is there suffering in the world, that never bothered me so much. For me, it was always just how do you take all these narratives about what God wants of us and what salvation is and make them all work together. And I never really came up with an answer for that, except that, yeah, either God doesn't exist or he does, but he's something that none of us has figured out. And that's a scary thing to have to live with, but and that's also something I kind of talking about in that scene of, like, you know, how do you go on not knowing? And the line that Horace's mother gives him in the end that I think is probably the closest thing to my own statement of faith is where that even a universe where God didn't exist could sometimes act like one where he does.
Yeah.
So you can still have hope even if you believe there's no ultimate meaning like that. I still really like being alive. I still love the things I see, and I find a way to hope and go on. And who knows? Maybe I'll be surprised when it's all over, you know?
Yeah. So. Well, the surprise when it's all over is something that I wanted to talk to both of you about, because you both have, like, really awesome ghosts in your stories. You have, like, delightful ghosts for people who have read The Reformatory, some fantastic ghosts. Hecate, you know, in the Lovecraft books are delightful. And so, yeah, like, that's definitely horror, it's definitely religion, but it's also, like, such a wonderful part of the stream of stories that we get to participate in, the ghosts. And my question to you all is, like, what are some of your favorite ghosty moments in your own work that you would like to share with people? I just realized, Tanari, like, my favorite one from yours in the Reformatory is, like, the one that I know that we probably can't talk about because people have not read it.
Yes.
Yeah, I know. But so, like, aside from that, like, any, like, the uses of ghosts.
I'm ready for it. Because, you know, the ghosts were really my salvation as the author of the Reformatory, which was based on my real life great uncle, Robert Stevens, who unfortunately died at the Dozier School for Boys in the 1930s. And I decided to fictionalize his story and move it to 1950 and give him a better story. I'll just put it that way. And the only way I could get through writing about this horrific facility, which terrorized generations of young people in Florida, was to use ghosts rather than page after page after page of children being murdered and beaten and tortured and assaulted sexually and otherwise. It's just, if you read about the Dozier School, and it's not very different from a lot of other so-called reformatories and schools throughout the world, you know, the only way I could make myself write this book, and it still took me 7 years, was to pay homage to those children who died through the use of ghosts and write it as a horror novel, because horror at its heart is meant to be entertaining, for lack of a better term. So how do you take a horrific story like that and make it entertaining? Well, ghosts were my answer for that. And my favorite nugget, to get to your question about those ghosts, besides my spoiler, is the method to summon a ghost, which is very simple on the surface, is you just say their full name. You call out their full name if you want a ghost to come to you. And this was especially meaningful to me because Robert Stevens, the real life Robert Stevens, was very much buried by his family. I never knew he existed before the state of Florida contacted me. One of my relatives was named for him and did not know for whom he was named. So I feel like this child was sort of wrested away from the family, and they buried him and their grief in a hole and did not speak his name. So for these young ghosts that were trapped on these grounds, for someone to call your name is it's just so overwhelming, and you can't resist it. It's irresistible. So yes, you've been forgotten. And of course, tying that in with the contemporary say their names, say her name, say his name movement, that is my favorite moment of ghostiness, is realizing that, oh, you call their name. It's that simple. Just call. They want to hear their name.
I remember that. That was such a lovely, lovely moment. I also kind of felt that there was sort of this beautiful and really smart embedded joke in sort of like the dynamics, because like very quickly on, when they land in the reformatory, they know there's ghosts, right? And then like the kids are like, no, no, we know there's ghosts. It's like, yeah, but who you really have to watch out for is like the white people in charge of the thing. And I was just, I loved, that was such a great, and
kind of the bait and switch, right? It's like,
it was so good. I was like, of course, like that.
You'll wish it was just a ghost bothering you that night.
Yeah. So I just thought that was brilliant. And Matt, your ghosts are also like, you both have like very charming ghosts, I guess. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's funny. I was thinking, I mean, in all of my novels, I think Lovecraft Country and I guess Destroyer of Worlds are probably the only ones where ghosts actually appear. I don't know if any of the others have that. And the obvious would be in the Dreams of the Witch House, I can't believe I'm blanking on the name, Winthrop, the ghost, mm-hmm. Who's this dead sorcerer who's basically, he's got a soul catcher in the basement of this mansion, so, and he's stuck in there. But basically, yeah, it's my haunted house story where the character Letitia comes into a windfall and decides to buy a house in a white neighborhood because she thinks she can, you know, and she gets this deal that is much too good to be true, and it's because the house is haunted. So, and it's this sort of the example of what I was trying to do with Lovecraft Country, playing off the paranormal horror against sort of more mundane horrors of Jim Crow, where yes, it's a haunted house, so she's got to deal with a ghost, and then there are also the white neighbors who want to burn the house down, and the ghost is white too, so none of them want her there. But, and her solution is to play the dead off against the living and get what she wants. And there is a moment in that where I just realize that the way this is going to work is she's going to win Winthrop over, and once he starts working with her, that's how she's going to win. And there's a moment when the local kids come by and they've got a truck full of cow manure and they're pelting the house with this, and she's freaking out and she's realizing she runs out with a shotgun, but she can't do anything with it because if she kills anybody, she's going to go to jail, not them. And then when she goes back in the house, the ghost is like set up a chessboard, and because she's been trying to get it to talk to her or play poker with her, and it sets up a chessboard and she's like, okay, you know, what do you want to play for? And the idea is, if I beat you, you're going to help me beat them. And that was one of my favorite moments in that novel. So.
I just wanted to put in a plug for something. I saw a lot of people with Lovecraft Country, which is an amazing novel. It's there. Matt, you wrote a sequel.
Yes.
That's fucking amazing, called Destroyer of Worlds. So if you love these characters, they keep having adventures, and the adventures are delightful. And
unlike the HBO series, I didn't kill off half the cast in the novel. So.
Yeah, yeah, that was very good.
God bless Misha Green, but she is a bloodthirsty gal. So
I can see it being fun to kill. And also, like, the other thing I was going to say about, like, as a final sort of thing, and as a shameless kind of shilling plug for the fact that we are in Chicago, Chicago plays a part in the reformatory, plays a part in the story of worlds. And so, yeah, you can just like say, like, you know, Chicago's awesome, buy my books if you want to, but like, these are Chicago people. No, how do you see Chicago play into your stories?
In the case of the reformatory, which is at its heart sort of a great migration novel, yeah. You know, if you really think about it, their father was chased out of town after a false rape accusation and ended up in Chicago. So Chicago is sort of this mythic land of freedom. In his children's eyes, they don't even blame the father for leaving. They kind of just dream of those big city streets. And I won't say anything spoilery beyond that. But yes, while obviously Chicago had its own pitfalls for newly arrived Black people from the South, it really did represent a kind of hope for change and hope for a better life.
And for me, I mean, it's funny. I think the main reason I chose Chicago, partly it's my the roughs come from this part of the country, so I kind of felt comfortable with the culture here. But Also, I wanted to set the novel in the North. There's this false notion that racism is a Southern problem, but when you start reading about this, you realize that, first of all, sundown towns are almost an exclusively Northern and Western phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Because the way racism manifests, it was the North where they wanted black people to just go away. The South was more about continuing the use of slave labor, so they were happy to have black folks around as long as they knew their place, and there was extensive signage to let you know what your place was. It's the North where you got sundown towns, and it's also the North where you had to play this guessing game, you know, where am I welcome and where am I not, because there were whites-only signs in some places, but a lot of the time you would just get messed with. The no vacancy sign would come on just as you were pulling up to a motel or a hotel. And that fit into this sort of Lovecraftian dread motif I started building when I started thinking about the novel as well. So it just made more sense to me to set it in a northern city and to explore an aspect of racism that I didn't think as many people were aware of. So that was the main reason for the choice. And it's centrally located, too. So
it is. There's also, like, I don't know if anybody follows Reductress Books on Instagram. They're fantastic. It's like the bookish arm of Reductress, like the Feminist Onion. And they have one where it just says, nice, place in book is place that the woman has been to. And there's a real joy and jolt, I think, for me when I was reading the work of both of you, when I was, it's like, oh yeah, I've been there. I know that. We have time for questions, and we're open to questions here. And I believe there's a microphone that Carrie's setting up for anybody. Yep.
I could start off with a question that I'll throw, and if anybody's taking a minute to think of a question, to both Tanana Reeve and to Matt and to Juan. You've talked about the relationship of religion and horror and family and faith and all of these different ideas. I'm kind of curious, overall, in a general sense, what has drawn you to horror as a genre through which to express complex ideas about race or family or these other things? What about this particular genre appeals to all three of you?
That's a great question, and it's difficult to answer, but I'll try to jump in really quickly. My late mother loved horror, and I used to think it was just sort of a quirk. Oh, she's this civil rights activist, but she loved horror. And over time, I grew to realize it was a direct result, probably, of having been a civil rights activist, having grown up in the Jim Crow South, that she embraced horror because it allowed her to sort of visualize fantasy monsters that could validate her real life fears, give her a face rather than sort of a faceless system, but just a face to vent against, to expel some of that energy. Every once in a while you get to win, but even if you don't win, horror is just full of so many examples of survival behaviors. I mean, even if it's what not to do, like don't trip and fall, do put on your shoes, do pick up a weapon, don't open the door, you know, it's just, it's a primer. And for people like me who are a little bit obsessed with mortality as I've been as a child, and that's always the underlying fear that draws me to horror. It just gives me so many different expressions of characters who stand up to that fear and give me lessons on how to overcome it.
I mean, yeah, my answer would be, I think, similar in that, I mean, the initial spark for Lovecraft Country was I wanted to do the X-Files. But it was going to be the X-Files if Mulder and Scully were black travel writers living in the Jim Crow era. And once I went there, the horror very much fit into what I was trying to do. And it was about, yes, which is the scarier thing, the monster under the bed or the policeman who pulls you off, you know, over at the edge of town right before sundown? And that was the question I was playing with. And yeah, so it was intrinsically, it was just an inherently a horror-type scenario. So.
Okay, I can answer this too. I was when I was living in Colombia and I was 14. I got misdiagnosed with a terminal disease. I was told that I had less than a year to live. And one of the things that I ended up doing was, and then I was getting progressively sicker. So I was like in bed. So I read a lot of Stephen King, and then like they discovered that it wasn't what they thought it was originally, or something else. And then many, many years later, was writing my what I thought was going to be my first novel, and it's about somebody feeling vaguely sad. And I started cheating on that novel with a horror novel, and I was like, I felt like I was sort of recapturing like the thing that had really made me happy and like hopeful and like just absorbed during the time that I was 14. But also, like, I don't know if like remember, like, you're never as like, I just remember like being fully in the dream of a book when I was 14 in a way that I don't think I've ever been. I mean, it happens once in a while, but like that was like a, I just wanted to get back to that, I think, which is weird. It's like, yeah, I wanted to be back to the moment where I was like super sick and in bed, but it's also kind of happy. Yeah.
To piggyback off of that question, when I read your books, I don't think of horror. I think more of supernatural or something that can be livable. Stephen King, to me, is horror. So what do you think, or is there a difference between horror and supernatural?
That's an interesting question. The great thing about horror as a genre is that it's just an emotion, right? So I just judged a horror contest, and it really just came down to, yeah, these are well-written stories, but it just didn't scare me. And being scared is a very subjective thing. So the categorization can be somewhat slippery. Supernatural horror, to me, is horror, or a story, rather, that has a supernatural element that scares you. You can have a supernatural story that isn't meant to scare you. It's about, you know, your friendly ghost neighbor that you have tea with every Sunday. That's not scary. It's interesting. So that, if I don't know if that's an answer, but that's the difference. I mean, you know it when you read it. It can be science fiction. It can be a thriller. It can be an action story. But if the primary core of it is to create fear and dread, that is generally what people consider horror to be.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, as far as the topic of faith and religion, is it something you've always explored in your writing, even when you began writing? Is it something that more started to filter in as you got older? And if it is something that later on filtered in, what was the catalyst for that?
I mean, for me, it's funny that I grew up knowing I wanted to write novels, and I would do this thing when I was younger where I would start writing and then I would go along, you know, they weren't really well structured. I would go along until I got bored. And then I would start again and again. And the first book I managed to finish was this thing called The Gospel According to St. Thomas. And it was basically my attempt in fiction to sort of let my parents know that I wasn't growing up to be the devout Lutheran that they'd hoped for. And I don't know that it was very good as a novel, but it because I cared enough about it, it got me to the end and proved that I could write a complete story. So, and since then, it's really depended on the specific novel to what extent religious themes come in and then the characters I'm particularly writing about, but it's always there and it's very useful. I mean, I've met people who grew up in, you know, completely atheist background, and it's sort of they're missing a piece of understanding what motivates a lot of people. It's kind of hard for them to figure out what the heck this means, whereas if you've been raised with this one set of really, in many ways, crazy myths, it makes it easier to understand other religious beliefs. And you might laugh, but, you know, you'll still, it's like, what, if you had a time in your life when you thought Noah's Ark was a true story, or, you know, then it's hard to laugh at other people's faith. And you can sort of see, like, okay, if I had grown up in that tradition, these things would mean just as much to me in the same way, sort of the way that belief works. So if that makes sense.
So yes, for me, having been raised Unitarian, I think I had a great curiosity about faiths, you know, multiple, like I remember doing deep dives into several faiths when I was in high school. But in terms of my writing, I think faith enters my writing somewhat by accident, except in a case like The Good House, where I did want to center it around voodoo and I hoped to do it in a respectful way. That was one exception. And then I had a book called My Soul to our blood colony, rather, where I tried to create what would an evil religion look like? Like what could be an evil religion sort of as a philosophical game? But beyond that, I think it's just because my characters are always faced with such extreme circumstances that they really do have to confront their faith or their non-faith. Like, I, you know, maybe I never believed in God, but I sure hope there is one because I need some help right now. or whatever it is, rejecting your grandmother's faith or not finding enough sustenance from your godmother's Christianity, or just searching for something solid to hold on to during the worst moment of your life.
I have a bit of a two-parter, so feel free to pick whichever one you like more if you'd like. But I'm curious to hear, as someone who writes horror as well, have there been occasions where in writing you were harrowed by your own writing? Like it began to scare you as it kind of developed, or even you thought, oh, I can't believe that came out of me. And whether it's horror writing or just horror, the genre in general, how has horror been healing for you?
Well, I'll start with the second part because I forgot the first part already. But no, have I scared myself all the time? All the time. Writing my first novel, I would regularly scare myself because I was writing late at night. I don't even watch or read horror late at night, you know, whether it's mine or anybody else's. I need comedy. I need lightness. So I've had to really regulate those hours, not to let those thoughts into my head right when I'm about to go to sleep. That's not when I want to be, you know, ruminating over my worst nightmares and all the bad things that can happen. But how is it healing? I'll tell you, you know, the example I like to use is a film called The Dark and the Wicked, which is a little horror film that you would find on Shudder, which has to do with caretaking for a dying parent. And anyone who's been in that situation knows that that is a harrowing experience, caretaking in general, you know, a person you love and care for, and you feel so helpless, and it can be so exhausting. But they also have a demon to deal with, right? So I would find myself watching that again and again. It's one of my comfort horror movies because...
Really?
Yeah, because it's like, yeah, it sucks, you know, my dad is in his 90s and it sucks that my mom passed away, but at least I never had to deal with the demon on top of that.
Okay.
Get it?
In a very real way. It's like, well, at least it's not that bad. You know, I mean, it's like you take real life and you turn it up to 11 in a horror novel and it's like, woo, compared to that, I've got it easy.
Hello, Ms. Dula. This is Kiana. I TA'd for you in your Black Horror class a couple years ago, so it's nice seeing you. I have been thinking about the first question in which this timescape is similar to things in the past, but I think about how does a surveillance state make it more uncanny nowadays, and how would you accompany that aspect of horror in your reflections?
Ooh, that's a heavy question. I'll just give you impressions rather than coherence, perhaps. My mother, having grown up and been a young person during the civil rights era, was forever afraid our phone was being tapped. So we were raised being told not to say things over the phone. She could be very cagey, even putting things in writing, you know. So I guess I feel like I've been prepared for the surveillance state in some ways my whole life. Not that you would know it from my social media history, which has been very loud in the past. But it is all part of a brewing horror story, isn't it? And I feel that reading horror in general, and I may not be answering your question as well as I could because it's too smart for me, but I do think that the muscles that horror readers build are very, very helpful when we're faced with real life survival situations, because so many of us fall to this idea, well, that couldn't ever happen. You know, and I think horror readers are like, oh, yes, it could, because you're always prepared. Like, your characters are always facing the worst thing that could happen. So, of course, the worst thing can happen. Of course, there could be an entire lockdown, you know, during COVID. And statistically, horror readers psychologically did a little better with that kind of an unexpected turn, because it's like, well, duh, you know, of course, there's going to be a lockdown. Haven't you read The Stand? At least it isn't that. It's not Captain Trips.
Yeah, and I think my problem is every time I've thought about surveillance, you end up thinking of things that come true. I mean, I straddled that generation coming into the, you know, the internet and social media and so many other things, where things that, you know, we used to wonder whether people could listen in on rotary phones when they were still on the hook. And now, of course, everybody carries a surveillance machine around in their pocket, and we absolutely know that we're being listened to. And the novel that I wrote that dealt most with this was Bad Monkeys, which is sort of my Philip K. Dick novel. And that one had a thing. There was a thing called library bindings, and it was basically the idea that this wacky organization had figured out a way to bug print books so that it knew how long you spent on any given page and what specific thing you were reading. And this was just before ebooks really blew up that I wrote about this. And I wasn't even thinking in advance, but of course, as soon as ebooks happened, this now Amazon actually does. Like it'll tell you what your favorite passage is. And so it's technology is like it's always jumping ahead that way. If you don't think about it in advance, they're going to figure out a way to do things you just it never occurred to you would be possible. So,
I'm just really interested in how you all use the genre, and really I'm thinking about just the universal principles that you all are addressing and truth. So, really like. I've been reading Tanner Reeves' book since I was 19. I'm 47 now, so I grew up with him. But my soul to keep, there's this kind of theme that these people, and even in your books, that what do you do with this truth or this knowledge, this power? And these people are just mucking it up. Like there's been, in her books, these guys have been around for like thousands of years. But you also have like this tension point, and I guess that's what I wanted you all to kind of discuss is like that tension point of just dealing with the everyday, like the evolution of like human relationships that I saw in your books and stuff like that. So that's my question. So how do you all build that tension?
Yeah. I love how you capped that question because I could sense it could have been big and you were like, ooh, I got it right here. You are absolutely right that I'm trying, like, a book like My Soul to Keep, which is about a woman who discovers her husband is a 500-year-old immortal, right? So there's this dance between the mundane world, the everyday, the husband and wife, you're going to work, you're fixing breakfast, you're taking your kid to school, with this huge secret history he has that I write about in these historical chapters. And he is very emotionally immature for someone who ought to be more mature after 500 years, but they live in isolation. They don't have to deal with mortals, right? They've been with the same dudes for 500 years. So it's when they're out in the world, they're almost as children or really as petulant as, like, say, Greek gods, you know? I mean, we're gods hanging out with mortals and, oh, you hurt my feelings. So, you know, whatever. So I really do try to use those bigger themes as a kind of a funhouse mirror where we can look at our mundane lives and remind ourselves, oh, we are not immortals. You know, we have to be mindful of how we spend our time. We have to be more mindful of our relationships and our choices because a 20-year mistake is a big chunk out of our lives. And that's kind of the point, is to just hold a mirror up to the reader through the horror premise so that you can see reality more clearly through that prism of fantasy.
I don't have any brilliant thing to say to add to that. I don't think so.
Well, with that, then, I would like us all to very much thank our authors for this evening. And I want to thank all of you for coming out on a Friday night, as Juan said. You have lots of options, and you all packed into this room, and we appreciate it. Tanana Reeve, thank you so much for logging in with all you have going on.
Thank you all so much. This was lovely.
Thanks, everybody. Have a great night.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.